You know, it's my great pleasure right now to introduce to everybody a man who really needs no introduction.
Carl.
Dragon.
King.
I'm not calling the fans geeks. I'm not calling them rednecks, tobacco chewing nothing, because I've done all that myself.
Carl.
Dragon.
King.
Carl.
In your dreams, you will see me.
Excuse me, please, let's don't talk negatively.
I'm going to win the title. I'm going to keep my money and buy me some good old Tennessee drinking whiskey with it.
Thank you for being such a great husband.
And this is for you, Fannie Mae. Solid gold, baby, just like you and me.
Hey, everybody. Carl Stern here from WrestlingObserver.com, Figure4Online.com, and my own website, WhenItWasCool.com. If you're hearing this over at Wrestling Observer, this is going to be a special biography week here. I'm going to deviate from my normal rotation of shows. In fact, probably for a little while, I'm going to mix in some biographies. What I'm doing very briefly is I had some success on our When It Was Cool free feed, which is our retro pop culture podcast, doing an A through Z of retro pop culture. And so that opened the door for quite a few new Patreons to join our website. So I thought I would do the same thing with my pro wrestling feed, the Dragon King Carl Ultimate History of Wrestling, which is a free feed you can get off of Apple, iTunes, Spotify, Amazon, wherever you get podcasts from. And so to do this, I went through our old older Patreon content and picked various wrestling-related shows, you know, started with Letters of the Alphabet. Now, most of these are biographies. Some of these are not. But there were several letters of the alphabet that I didn't really have a good choice for, or the one that I wanted to use maybe was, you know, a little tired for the time or something. I'm not sure. Just didn't strike my fancy. So I need to do several new biographies or new history specials to complete that series. So this is the first of those, the first one I came to that I didn't really want to use any of the older content I had. It's for the letter E. And so for this series, and this series again is to encourage you to become a Patreon supporter at whenitwascool.com, where we have almost 2,000 shows in our archives. So let's talk about the letter E, and I've chosen to represent the letter E, Earthquake, John Tenta, one of my favorite WWE heels of all time. And it's not somebody that I was a big fan of at the time. I've come to like John Tenta. Back during the very late 1980s, early 1990s, when John Tenta first came into WWE, I was my interest in wrestling had started to wane a little bit. I just graduated high school, or was graduating high school at the time John Tenta came to WWE. And so I was watching wrestling a little less, you know, getting out there in the world a little more, starting to figure out what college I was going to and things of that nature. You know, becoming an adult. And so I wasn't spending every Saturday and Sunday in front of the television set watching pro wrestling. I had real life things to do. And so John Tenta kind of came in under my radar a little bit. I was still reading all the wrestling magazines, and it didn't take long before I was back, you know, regularly watching wrestling all the time, and Tenta had become a pretty big star. Later on, as I get older, especially over the last, I would say, 10 years or so, I've become really a fan of John Tenta. I just like the guy. He was huge. He was one of those big bruisers, and that was the top wrestler I liked. I know that's not everybody's, you know, jumping, flipping, five-star match kind of people, but I was always a fan of the guys like Vader and, you know, Steve Dr. Death Williams and Terry Gordy and even the bigger monster guys like a Big John Studd. I mean, maybe I'm the only Big John Studd fan in the world, but I liked Big John Studd when he was a wrestler. A lot of people found him boring. I thought he was big and intimidating looking. I remember the first time I saw Big John Studd live, I thought, oh, man, this guy's great. This guy's awesome. You know, I wasn't worried about how many star ratings his match was going to have. I loved him and Ken Patera as a team. I loved him and King Kong Bundy as a team. I just liked that type guy. And here, John Tenta was definitely well in that category. What I didn't know was really John Tenta's background. I mean, he was just a big guy from Canada. I gathered that much. But I had no idea he was actually a standout amateur wrestler down at LSU, the Louisiana State University. In fact, you could say John Tenta's pro wrestling debut was actually years earlier. Now, he didn't really debut in pro wrestling, but surprisingly enough, and many people may not know this, he was mentioned several times back in the mid-1980s by, of all people, Bill Watts on Mid-South Wrestling TV. He would bring up some of the great amateur wrestlers that were down at LSU, and he a few different times mentioned John Tenta on TV, having no idea that John Tenta would ultimately become a star professional wrestler. Many people are aware that John Tenta was a sumo wrestler, a former sumo wrestler. Is that true? Yes, it is true. And as a matter of fact, at the end of this program, I'm going to play a pretty lengthy interview that took place with the Canadian Broadcasting Company, the CBC, interviewing John Tenta about him leaving sumo and returning to Canada. And it's a fascinating interview. I'll be honest with you. John Tenta is utterly devoid of charisma. He is very soft-spoken. He seems like the nicest guy you'd ever meet. His answers are smiling and soft-spoken, and you think, this can't be the Canadian earthquake, John Tenta, but it is. And so I'll play that interview for you, and he answers, you know, all the person's questions, and it's just so much stark contrast to what we would know from John Tenta. Of course, there's the famous angle with John Tenta on the Brother Earthquake on the Brother Love show attacking Hulk Hogan, and I'll play that for you about our mid-show break or so. But let's talk about John Anthony Tenta Jr. Who is this man? Born June 22nd, 1963, and sadly, we have to report he died June 7th, 2006. Down the road sometime in from the pages of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter podcast that I do, we'll get to John Tenta and his death. Very sad. He was only, man, and this is heartbreaking, he was only 42 years old when he died. He was still a young guy. Still could have probably had a significant career ahead of him, at least a few more years, even as big and heavy as he was, used sparingly. And one thing about John Tenta is it seems so many people liked him. He seemed like he had this great reputation behind the scenes of being just a nice guy, even though he was involved in one of the very rare in-ring shoot incidents. It took place over in Japan, a very famous one, and of course we'll talk about it. But he maintained a lot of friendships outside the ring, in pro wrestling, and was well-beloved. And so a good guy, and it's good to talk about a good guy. So John Tenta Jr. was a Canadian professional wrestler and later sumo wrestler, best known, of course, for his work in the WWF as Earthquake. He initially debuted as the Canadian Earthquake, but they soon dropped the Canadian portion of the name. He was Earthquake. After a promising start to his sumo career, using the name, and I'm going to try to get this right here, I'm hit and miss with my Japanese names, Koto Tenzan. That was his sumo name. John Tenta switched to professional wrestling and became a high-profile star in the WWF, feuding with Hulk Hogan. He, of course, won the WWF Tag Team Championship with his partner, Typhoon, that, of course, being Fred Ottman, another guy who has a reputation of being a good guy, nice guy wrestler, formerly Tugboat. His professional wrestling career also encompassed runs in World Championship Wrestling, where he was known by the alternate names of the Avalanche and then later the Shark. And his WCW run was much less successful than his WWF one. He was obviously Earthquake, but he kept being put in these really kind of silly gimmicks with the Dungeon of Doom, and he never got built up nearly to the degree he did in WWF. He had a run in All Japan Pro Wrestling, and we'll talk about the deal that happened over there. And then he had a very short deal as Golga, wearing a mask in WWF, and it was part of a very, as many WWF angles have been, very silly, dumb kind of angle. But John Tenta died in 2006, and what did he die from? Unfortunately, it was a battle with bladder cancer. John Tenta was born in Canada, in British Columbia, actually. How he ended up at LSU is kind of an interesting story, I guess. He was named after his father. And he was a large baby, supposedly weighing 11 pounds, 3 ounces at birth. And we all know a lot of times these giants born as large children is often more fantasy than fact, but who knows, maybe he was. He was inspired by professional wrestlers Gene Kaniski, legendary Canadian wrestler, and Don Leo Jonathan. John Tenta decided to pursue wrestling very early on in his life. He learned freestyle wrestling while he was in high school. He became a Canadian junior champion in 1981. So you got this big guy who's a shooter. He's legit. He for real amateur professional wrestling. In fact, so much so that shortly after his 18th birthday, he finished sixth in the super heavyweight category at the World Junior Wrestling Championships in Vancouver. He won a scholarship to LSU, Louisiana State University. He competed in NCAA level collegiate wrestling. And I tried to find his John Tenta's amateur or LSU record. And would you believe that not only did he wrestle at LSU, but he was on the rugby team as well. Supposedly he played football, and I'm a little sketchy about whether he actually played football there or not. Maybe he did, but I'm hard pressed to find documentation of that. As well as his amateur record at LSU seems a little bit nebulous as well, but we know he did it. I mean, we know he did, even to the degree that that Bill Watts was mentioning him on Mid-South Wrestling Television at the time, which is, if you think back, that's kind of strange a little bit, I guess, or interesting, I suppose. But I wish his sumo record we could find. I mean, we got his sumo record for the most part, but it's very hard to find anything about his amateur record. Maybe there's some sleuths out there that can come up with his record at LSU. But nevertheless, at LSU, he's nicknamed Big John Tenta, obviously, in the lettering on the Tiger varsity wrestling team and participating on the football team as well. So I guess he earned a letter in football also. You know, I should that around that time, I mean, I was heavily following SEC football, but I guess he didn't probably start or anything like that. I don't know. But now, it also should be known that LSU wasn't exactly a wrestling amateur wrestling powerhouse. In fact, they dropped. They were one of the colleges that dropped amateur wrestling to comply with Title IX in 1985. You remember the Title IX was the Women's Act, where you had to have the same number of men's scholarships as women's scholarships. And because there, at that time especially, there weren't as many women's sports being offered by colleges, the way that many schools complied was to cut men's scholarships in sports. And oftentimes wrestling was what fell to the axe of that, and that's what happened. That's why Tenta then supposedly walked on as a football player after losing his scholarship, and I'm sure he played on the line in some capacity. Tenta moved to Japan, and I don't know really what inspired him to, I mean, that's quite a leap to go from Louisiana State University to where you lost your wrestling scholarship, you may have dabbled in some football, to move to Japan to become a sumo wrestler. And this happened around 1985. In October of 1985, he joined a sumo stable ran by former Yokozuna Kotsukura Matsukatsu. And I'm understanding that my vague understanding of this is Tenta had gone back home to Vancouver, and there was some sort of recruiting trip from the sumo over to Canada, and he somehow, you know, that's how he involved himself with that. So again, it's very, he's in wrestling through these very strange and somewhat unusual channels, I guess. So he goes to Japan, and as part of tradition there, he's low man on the totem pole. You know, sumo had a very strict system of much as talk has been made about the young boy system in Japanese pro wrestling. Well, sumo is like even more strict. He was only 22 years old, and with the combination of his size, and at that time he was over 400 pounds, and he was over 6 foot tall. In fact, depending on what sources you use, about 6 foot five or so. And he won 24 bouts in his 8 month career. He was undefeated. So that is got him some attention. I mean, for one, for a Westerner, a white guy from Canada to be a sumo wrestler, that's noteworthy back in 1985 to begin with, and to be so successful also pretty interesting. His name he was given, again, was Koto Tenzan, which supposedly translates Heavenly Mountain Harp. That's one of those, probably something lost in translation there. Despite doing well as a newcomer, he soon quit the sport due to the difficulty of the sumo lifestyle and the toll the hard ring surface was taking on his body. Tenta commented, "Nothing I've ever done, not football, not college wrestling, compares with the kind of physical abuse you inflict on your body in sumo." In addition, the sumo world frowned on the large tattoo of a tiger on his left bicep, which again, that is Louisiana State University's mascot, it's the tiger. And in fact, if you look at sumo pictures of John Tenta, they've covered it up. He has to wear like a wrap on his arm to cover the tattoo up. Oh, interesting. In fact, they even, for him to move up in levels, they wanted him to have it removed by whatever means necessary. Skin grafts. We got to remember this is mid-80s. You know, laser removal was in its very early days. So he had some things working against him there. John Tenta's decision to quit was criticized by the stable master, while the head of the Japan Sumo Association said that Tenta had become arrogant after his run of consecutive victories. Quote, "He thought it would be easy, but there's no job in this world that is harder. It is better for him to leave." So, you know, he was looked down on in sumo. He was being probably bullied because he was a Westerner in sumo. And probably good he left. And in the interview I'll tack on to the end of this show where he's coming back home to Canada from sumo, you'll hear him talk a little bit more in detail about how rigorous this was. So now what we're really interested in is how did he come to be involved in professional wrestling? Well, as he tells the interviewers, you'll hear in that interview, that he's going back to Japan, and this time to compete in Japanese professional wrestling, specifically All Japan Pro Wrestling. So he's going to work for Giant Baba. He made his pro wrestling debut with All Japan on May 1st, 1987, teaming with Giant Baba and defeating Rusher Kimura and Goro Tsurumi. Tenta had a solid 18-month run, teaming with Baba and Jumbo Tsuruta, Great Kabuki, before getting the attention of American pro wrestling promoters, as well as making tours in Vancouver for Al Tomko's All-Star Wrestling promotion. So, obviously, I mean, people, come on, they're going to be impressed by this guy. Number one, he's a giant sumo in Japan who had success, basically undefeated. At that point in time, he could literally do a standing drop kick. So, of course, people are going to be interested in this guy. He had a couple dark match appearances as John Tenta. in March of 1989 for the WWF. And then he joined the WWF full-time in September of 1989 in his first match signing on. He portrayed actually not Earthquake, Canadian Earthquake, not anything like that. Weirdly enough, he was a lumberjack. Yes, we know WWF loves its gimmicks, loves its young lumberjack. He debuted September 21st, 1989 as Earthquake Evans. Yes, he was managed by Slick, and he defeated Paul Roma in his debut. But we know things had changed up from there. Tenta then made his WWF television debut on November 11th, 1989, on an edition of WWF Superstars of Wrestling, where he was planted in the audience as a normal spectator at the taping held at Wheeling, West Virginia. During an in-ring interview with Gene Okerlund, Dino Bravo challenged the Ultimate Warrior to a strength competition. In order to demonstrate, Dino Bravo and his manager Jimmy Hart suggested they pick a random audience member to come to the ring and sit on the back of Bravo and the Ultimate Warrior as they did push-ups to see who could do the most. Ultimate Warrior agreed to this, and Jimmy Hart, after pretending to look around the audience, centered his attention on the very large Tenta, who was sitting in the audience in casual clothing and appeared to be surprised. John Tenta came down to the ring, identified himself as, quote, John from West Virginia. So we get, he's two appearances into WWF now, Earthquake Evans and John from West Virginia. This is not starting out that great. He proceeded to sit on Dino Bravo's back as he did a set of push-ups. During Ultimate Warrior set, however, Tenta leapt down upon the prone Ultimate Warrior using a, you know, the big Andre the Giant seated butt squash that, of course, Tenta would also become pretty famous for. Bravo and Tenta then beat and unleashed multiple big splashes on the beaten-down Warrior. Both then celebrated as Tenta was inaugurated into the WWF as part of Jimmy Hart's stable there. His name was then changed to the Canadian Earthquake, and by the time WrestleMania 4, or excuse me, 6 rolled around, he was simply Earthquake. Earthquake's first pay-per-view appearance was when he replaced, of all people, Barry Windham on Randy Savage's team at the 1989 Survivor Series. Yep, Barry had to disappear. His family had been, his father and brother had been indicted for counterfeiting, and he had to go home and take care of family business, and so he's replaced by Earthquake. Earthquake eliminated Hercules and survived the match, along with Randy Savage and Dino Bravo. He made his WrestleMania debut at WrestleMania 6, defeating Hercules. I think most people would consider the biggest moment of John Tenta's career was his feud with Hulk Hogan. Perfectly made for Hulk Hogan, right? Just big, giant monster of the month club. The feud exploded in May 1990 when Earthquake snuck up on Hulk Hogan from behind during a segment on the Brother Love show and repeatedly crushed Hulk Hogan's ribs with his Earthquake splash. So I take you now to a clip of this here deal. The guy, in case you didn't know, with a high-pitched voice telling you he loves you is, of course, none other than Brother Love, a.k.a. I always think of him as Tom Pritchard's brother, but Bruce Pritchard is, of course, one of the heads of creative in WWE, even to this day. So that's Bruce Pritchard as Brother Love. And here is your this is a career-peaking moment for probably anybody to do a beatdown on Hulk Hogan.
The fans won't have to listen to you. They won't have to listen to me. And you and I can get a bird's eye view of the Brother Love show. Come on, let's go down to the Brother Love set.
Hulk! Please. All right, come on. Okay, come on.
So this feud would be pretty successful, and at a time when wrestling's about to fall off a cliff now, all the way around. This is the tail end of the good year still happening. Hulk Hogan had a countout victory, SummerSlam 1990 over Earthquake. Hogan and Earthquake were the final two participants in the 1991 Royal Rumble, with Hulk Hogan, of course, winning that match. But I mean, hey, that's a pretty big deal, right? With Earthquake being one of the last men in there. After his feud with Hulk Hogan, Earthquake defeated his former stablemate Greg Valentine at WrestleMania 7. On April 1st, 1991, WWF held a joint show in Japan with the Japanese promotion Super World Sports. It's called Wrestle Dream, and Earthquake appeared to face Koji Katao in a battle of two former sumo wrestlers. Well, there's a problem here. Katao and Tenta both broke kayfabe. They were uncooperative with one another. Katao didn't sell Earthquake's attacks and shot on him. The match ended when Katao was disqualified for kicking the referee. Koji Katao was a infamously difficult person to work with. Katao got on the microphone, started telling everybody in the audience wrestling's fake and that Tenta couldn't really beat him. Of course, this got Katao fired from SWS. This video is readily available. Honestly, they both looked scared of one another. They both looked like neither one really want to do this. Most people I've ever heard talk say Earthquake, John Tenta probably would have eaten him up in a real fight, but sumo was... You know, what were they going to do? This was the middle of a pro wrestling match. Were they going to break out into a sumo match? Were they going to fight? What were the rules? Were there no rules? I think Katao started this. And you could tell, like, really, Earthquake, really, I don't think was doing anything out of the way or whatever. And it just broke down. It just broke down. And instead of, you know, professionally figuring a way out of it, Katao, again, very infamously difficult guy to work with. But I guess he recovers from this here incident. After WrestleMania 7, Earthquake instigated a feud with Jake the Snake Roberts. And know where this is going. On WWF Superstars Wrestling, he squashed Damien. Yes, he did the fat butt drop on Damien, killing the snake, supposedly. This everybody gets up and, I mean, you got all kinds of people mad about this here thing that happens. Could you imagine here in today's world with today's sensitivities, this angle going on? Like, oh my gosh, the uproar that would cause. Anyway, the match aired on Superstars of Wrestling. Footage of Earthquake landing on Damien was interrupted with cutaway shots that showed the event center, although the incident aired uninterrupted and uncensored on Primetime Wrestling. And Earthquake participated in a skit on Primetime Wrestling where he cooked Quake burgers on a grill and served them co-hosts Vince McMahon, Bobby Heenan, and Lord Alfred Hayes, insinuating or outright saying that they had eaten Damien. This is very much a WWE thing to do. How stupid. But that's what happened. They would even relive this angle sort of later on with, like, Big Boss Man Al Snow and eating a dog or something like that. It's just so dumb. That's WWF humor for you. So later 1991, where do you go from that? Where do you go from feuding with Hulk Hogan and Jake Roberts and butt squashing the snake and all this? What do you do next? Well, fortunately, he recovered pretty well because he ends up a tag team with fellow fat guy Typhoon, Fred Ottman. And the two were friends. Outside the ring, of course, Fred Ottman very well known, another nice guy in wrestling, previously been Tugboat. And this was a great way to salvage these two guys. I mean, Tugboat wasn't going anywhere. Earthquake had peaked with the Hogan and Roberts feud. So putting them together in a tag team was a pretty good idea. The Natural Disasters, Earthquake and Typhoon, that's a great name for a team. And of all people to get to feud with, the Legion of Doom, yes, the Road Warriors, are the WWF Tag Team Champions. So that's a great team to feud with. Four big, giant guys just clubbering each other, to quote Dusty Rhodes. That's good stuff. Again, not necessarily five-star matches, but hey, for a young kid, that's great. Get these four giant guys, two of them muscle monsters, two of them big, tall, fat guys, just fighting it out, fat guys fighting. Who doesn't love something like that? That's awesome. So, anyway, they work with them. But it is a Big Money Incorporated that dethrones, being, of course, Ted DiBiase and Mike Rotundo, Irwin R. Schyster. They actually get the tag team titles over the Legion of Doom. And at WrestleMania 8, the Natural Disasters defeated Money Incorporated by count out, but didn't win the titles. But they eventually did. Eventually won the tag team titles. And at the 1992 SummerSlam pay-per-view, they had the awe-inspiring match of beating the Beverly Brothers. Yes. You know, it's weird, the Beverly Brothers look. If you only know them from WWF, it's too bad. Okay, so Vince McMahon was a fan of the Valiants, Jimmy and Johnny Valiant, who had been around in his father's day. He was young man then, and liked that act. And so the Beverly Brothers were an attempt to recreate the Valiants. It just didn't work. Wayne Bloom and Mike Enos had been very successful in the AWA. In fact, they'd been AWA World Tag Team Champions. They'd had a brief run under Mask as Minnesota Wrecking Crew 2 in WCW. But they were both considered up-and-coming guys. But the problem is they only up and came to this Beverly Brothers gimmick, and that was that, as they say. They didn't really, never really excelled much beyond that. I think Wayne Bloom ended up hurting his back pretty bad. Mike Enos treaded water for many years thereafter. He was in WCW for a while, and a regular on Nitro, but he never really broke out to that next level, and it's too bad. John Tenna ended up leaving the WWF in January of 1993 after losing by countout to Bam Bam Bigelow the night after the Royal Rumble, and he went back to Japan, had a brief run in the War promotion over there, one of my favorite wrestling promotion names, War. You say, War, wow, that's a great name for a pro wrestling promotion, because they're at war. Well, no, it's an acronym. It stands for Wrestling and Romance, which is one of the most ridiculous names I think is ever. Like, I thought Noah was a weird name for a wrestling promotion when that all started. But look, I don't think you can beat Wrestling and Romance. He also briefly went, and this is one that is utterly forgettable, CMLL. Yes, the CMLL Lucha Libre promotion in 93. Well, he comes back to WWF, but doesn't really work out, though. He returned to WWF in January 1994. He assisted Bret Hart in a match with Shawn Michaels by countering Diesel's interference. He defeated Adam Bomb in a squash match at WrestleMania 10. He had a short feud with Yokozuna. And he and Yokozuna had a, I think I just said Yokozuma. Obviously, I meant Yokozuna. Obviously, this is going to be based around the sumo deal, and they even had a sumo match on Raw as well. Tenta won the sumo match, by the way. He was scheduled to face Owen Hart in a King of the Ring qualifying match. However, on May 14, 1994, at a house show in San Jose, California, Earthquake was injured by Yokozuna and Crush. Yokozuna hit a bonsai drop at the show, and that's what they used to explain that Tenta was out for a while, but then he was gone. He was back out of WWF again. It was a really enigma of a little run there. He was getting kind of pushed a little bit, but it just was over as soon as it started, it seems like. Well, enter WCW. There's a new player in the game at this point in time. Actually, it's an old player in the game, but they've rebranded as World Championship Wrestling. And he's perfect because we got Hulk Hogan coming in over here, and Hulk Hogan's trying to gather up all the people that he had, you know, successful feuds with so he could redo them in WCW, and obviously John Tenta's one of them. Hulk Hogan lobbied for him to come in, so Tenta comes in, but briefly he goes back to Japan, works for that UWFI group that was sort of a pseudo-shoot kind of deal over there. So he works that promotion. Even teams with Vader. Yeah, Big Van Vader, who's working as Super Vader in that deal. That was, I need to look that match up. I'd like to see that match, actually. Tenta was introduced as Avalanche. Yeah, got another natural disaster name, I guess. Avalanche. And was a member of Kevin Sullivan's Three Faces of Fear. He was built at 517 pounds, and I don't know if he was legit at that or not, but he was certainly huge. He later teamed with Big Bubba Rogers and feuded with Sting and Randy Savage. At the Clash of Champions 29, Avalanche, The Butcher, no, not Abdullah the Butcher, but of all people, Brutus Beefcake, Ed Leslie, doing a, I don't even know what you, how you describe as, Brutus Beefcake wearing black clothes was The Butcher. I don't even know. Anyway, he teams with him and Kevin Sullivan. They lost to Hulk Hogan, Sting, and Dave Sullivan. Now, if you're a newcomer and you say, Dave Sullivan, who's Dave Sullivan? Well, he's supposed to be Kevin's brother. He was formerly known as the Equalizer. He was kind of a Dollar General version of Bruiser Brody in some places. But no, he is the learning impaired brother of Kevin Sullivan. They were making fun, I kid you not, of dyslexic people. Like, what the hell? But anyway, he would spell his name Evod backwards for Dave. That's not even how dyslexia works. But anyway, that's what they were doing. And that's who could, look, pro wrestling, everybody. Pro wrestling. As if that wasn't enough, special referee for that match, Mr. T. That's right, fool. At Starrcade, Avalanche lost to Sting by disqualification. At Super Brawl 5, Avalanche and Big Bubba Rogers lost to Sting and Randy Savage when Sting pinned Avalanche. At Uncensored, which is the stupidest and worst of all WCW pay-per-views, it don't even matter which number or which year Uncensored is, I can promise you something stupid was unfolding there. Avalanche lost Randy Savage by disqualification, probably in a no-disqualification match. I don't remember and don't want to. At Clash of the Champions 30, Avalanche lost to Sting with the Guardian Angel. That's Big Bubba Rogers, by the way, Big Boss Man, as special referee. So I guess they figured at this point, well, we've got enough mileage out of the Avalanche name. I think what actually happened is WWE threatened to sue them because, hey, you're basically, this is the earthquake. You've just changed the name. It's the same thing. It's the same person, the same gimmick. So what did they do? Well, they turned him into the shark. Now, why the shark? I don't know. Why not the whale? The whale would have, you know, at least then you've got the biggest mammal in the Faces of Fear stable. But no, it's the shark. He's painting his face. It's totally stupid. I remember seeing the shark live and in person for the first time ringside at one of those WCW Nitros. He worked a dark match there. And he comes by, and it's like he didn't even, or maybe it was whoever done it for him, didn't even try to paint his shark face on. Like, he made these shark teeth and war paint up the side of his face, and it looked absolutely stupid. I'll never forget that. It was ridiculous anyway. By this time, the Faces of Fear stable had become the Dungeon of Doom, and he fit right into this bizarre group. Then get this. This is shades of coming up in a few weeks or soon. I don't know when I'm going to tape the show. One of the letters I'm doing is the letter O. That's a new show I'm going to be taping. And I chose for it One Man Gang. Okay, One Man Gang, another big, fat, terrifying guy, another well-liked guy. So I thought I would feature them in my in my stuff here. Well, he did something similar one time in that they proposed a angle is proposed to him, a feud is proposed to him, and he went and got a tattoo about it on his head. He literally got a tattoo about this. I'll talk about it when we get there. So here in WCW, John Tenta is so enamored by what he's going to be doing that that tiger tattoo that he has on his upper bicep, you know, for LSU, which he wrestled once upon a time, where he got in trouble in sumo for having it, he gets it changed to a shark. Yes, a shark. At Fall Brawl 1995, John Tenta teamed with other members of the Dungeon of Doom. Listen to this motley crew here. Kamala, the Zodiac. Okay, you remember when I was talking about the Butcher Brutus Beefcake earlier? Well, he's now the Zodiac. Ming and the Taskmaster, Kevin Sullivan. They are to face the Hulkamaniacs, Hulk Hogan, Randy Savage, Lex Luger, and Sting in a War Games match, and of course they lost. On October 9th, 1995, on an edition of WCW Monday Nitro, the Shark lost to Sting in a match for the WCW U.S. title. On a November 20th episode of Nitro, Shark lost to Scott Norton. He did compete in WCW World War III, which was that big 60-man over-the-top rope battle royal where they were trying to outdo the Royal Rumble. So they put, you know, three rings together and had 60 men. It was for the vacant WCW heavyweight title. Randy Savage won that one. And, you know, he's around WCW still for another year or so. Okay, he leaves the Dungeon of Doom, but he has numerous matches around. Obviously, in this stage, I mean, we're getting into the Monday Night War era between Nitro and Raw. And so everybody's contracting up all the wrestlers they could possibly put under contract just so the other side couldn't get them. And that's when, you know, he stuck around really till the early part of 1997, where he returns to the WWF, and this, again, was probably a ill-conceived idea. He resurfaced in WWF on the May 25th, 1998 episode of Raw's War. So you think, well, you got a guy that once upon a time feuded with Hulk Hogan here in WWF, Earthquake. We've got all these names and likenesses trademarked. We even threatened to sue WCW over the trademarks. He's been down in our main opposition, who is really dealing us misery here in the ratings war. We've got him back over here, so here's Earthquake. Nope. They've put a mask on his head and changed his name to Golga and put him with a group called the Odysseys, or the Oddities. Got to keep speak today. Oddities. Yes. And, you know, because why not? He's got a fascination with Cartman from South Park. So supposedly the gimmick was given to John Tenta because he had lost a considerable amount of weight, so much so that WWF thought it wouldn't be believable for him to reprise the Earthquake role. What? July 28th, 1998 on Raw's War, he beat Mark Marrow. At SummerSlam, the Oddities defeated Kai and Tai, who was the Japanese Michinoku team of Taka Michinoku, Dick Togo, Mince Teo, and Sho Funaki. Yeah, that was a thing that actually happened once upon a time. They do all these matches with the poor Legion of Doom's back, Road Warriors, and they're having their problems in WWF. We got draws in there, too, with them. So they have a battle with them, the Disciples of Apocalypse. God, just all these totally forgettable stables from your 1998 era WWF, Los Barriquas, and the list goes on and on. He was in the 1999 Royal Rumble, by the way, but he was eliminated pretty quickly by Steve Austin, and then the Oddities disappeared. You know, one thing that people forget is that he did actually come back as Earthquake in 2001 for WWF. He was in a 20-man gimmick battle royal at WrestleMania 17, And then he had a dark match in December that same year on SmackDown. So when he wasn't in WWF after he left and everything, he did a little bit of independent wrestling, but never really anything big. And I'm not sure how sick he was at this point and stuff. He became one of the early kind of online wrestling fan accessible wrestlers during this, you know, 99 through 2004 time period. He was a guy who would regularly show up on wrestling message boards, and answer fans' questions and participate. And he seemed just, he was a really enduring, nice kind of guy. And I think that positively affected his legacy to a lot of people as wrestling's popularity was exploding on the internet in that time. Your real hardcore fans were seeking out wrestling news and information on there. And he ends up retiring in 2004 when he revealed, revealed online that he had bladder cancer and it was likely terminal. In fact, he had stated at one point in time he had probably about a 20% chance of beating it, which he did not. He did have chemo and all the other stuff. Bruce Pritchard tells the story of him going in for treatments, and I forget exactly what Bruce's health issue was, but he ran into John Tenta at the same place he was going to get treatments and didn't even recognize him. So that's how unfortunately bad it went. So during November 18, 2005 interview on WrestleCrap Radio, and a shout out to the good folks over at WrestleCrap, John Tenta announced that a recent radiation dosage did not go as planned and had no effect on the tumor. He also announced that multiple tumors had spread to his lungs. And on June 7, 2006, John Tenta died of cancer at the age of 42. So very unfortunate, very sad, but again, a life well lived to a nice guy, John Tenta, who had a very interesting career. Rising from obscurity in Canada to get an athletic scholarship at a major college here in the United States. And, even after they yanked the amateur wrestling scholarship out from under him, he tried to walk on and play football. He ends up going to Japan to compete in sumo. And again, we'll hear this CBC interview about his return from sumo. And again, it's very interesting. You won't even recognize John Tenta speaking. He's young. He's very soft-spoken. He smiles through the whole thing. He's just the nicest guy in the world. And while he's utterly devoid of charisma, I think you'll glean some interesting information about him from this interview. It runs about 5 minutes, so it's a pretty lengthy interview, but there's a lot of stuff in it. Throughout his career, he did win several championships, although he never hit the big one, the world championship, but, I almost wish he had at some point in time got, a world championship of some sort, because I think he was that good. For All Japan Pro Wrestling, he won the annual January Battle Royal in 1988. In the Vancouver All-Star promotion. He was their Canadian heavyweight champion once. In that SWS promotion we talked about over in Japan, he was tag team champion one time with Typhoon. He was Tokyo Sports Rookie of the Year 1987. In the WWF, he held the WWF Tag Team Championship once with Typhoon, of course. And for the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Awards, he got three of them. Unfortunately, all three were in the negative categories. He got Worst Tag Team in 1998 with Kurgan, Worst Gimmick in 1998 as Golga, part of the Oddities, and in 1996, Worst Feud of the Year versus Big Bubba Rogers. And that's unfair. I'm not saying he didn't deserve those awards, but to look at his Wrestling Observer Awards based on who he was and what he did in pro wrestling, it's kind of unfair. It really gives a not accurate depiction of his pro wrestling career. So that is the letter E for Earthquake. And now I will leave you with this interview. It runs 4 minutes, 29 seconds as John Tenta talks to the CBC in Canada about quitting sumo wrestling, his experience as a Westerner, as a Canadian with sumo wrestling, and what his upcoming plans are, where he says straight up, I'm going into professional wrestling. And we'll leave you with that. In the meantime, I hope you will go to my website, whenitwascool.com, and hope you will be encouraged to become a Patreon supporter over there, where we have about 2,000 podcasts waiting for you and a new podcast almost every single day. Won't you at least go see what we got over there? Go to whenitwascool.com and just look around. Hey, we got a lot of free stuff over there too, and hope you'll check it out. Thank you very much for listening, and let's listen to John Tenta now talk about his sumo career.
Joining us now from Surrey, BC, John Tenta. Welcome home, John.
Thank you very much.
I was expecting to see you with long hair. When did you get a cut?
I got that cut, I guess, the day after I announced I was finished with sumo.
You didn't waste any time.
It was too long. I didn't like messing with it every day. Unless it's up in the top knot, it's hard to handle.
What was it about the lifestyle of the sumo wrestler that you said, I've had enough, I don't want to take this anymore?
There's a lot of demands and a lot of pressure put on you. I had to answer to guys that were much younger than me. I had to do anything that my senior wrestlers asked me.
Can you give us an indication of the type of hours that you put in? How much training went into this sport?
Well, during a tournament, I'd get up every morning about 5:30, and we'd have practice, and then we'd have lunch, and then if I had a match, I'd have to go to the stadium, look after a senior wrestler, then come back, make sure, look after him while he ate. So I wouldn't get rest, until probably about 7:30 in the evening.
I read somewhere that you were a little tired about having sand pushed up your nose and into your mouth.
Well, I didn't really get too much of that. Got hit a little bit with sticks and a little bit of kicking and punching, but it was just a whole bunch of little things overall that worked into one big thing.
Why did they put you through that kind of harsh training?
Well, they're trying to get you to your top condition so that you don't feel pain. If you're sick or injured, you practice anyway. Because during a tournament, if you have a match, you have a match, and you have to be there. So they're just trying to get you mentally tough and physically tough.
You know that some of the articles indicate that perhaps the Japanese thought you might be a little soft for giving up and quitting the sport at this time.
Well, some people criticized me, but a lot of the Japanese press was also on my side. The system isn't run, I don't feel, is run very well. A lot of other people feel it's not run well.
What was the good side of sumo? I mean, was there any good side of this sport for you?
Well, I don't regret going. I had a good time. I've become well known in Japan. I enjoyed myself. And now it's opened doors for other opportunities.
Well, what will you be doing? What does a retired sumo wrestler do?
Well, this one plans on going into professional wrestling back in Japan.
You're going back to Japan?
Yes, hopefully very soon.
Will you become the Hulk Hogan of Tokyo?
Well, before I become the Hulk Hogan of Tokyo, I have to lose my sumo body and turn into a wrestling body, lose a little weight.
How much weight have you lost since you quit training?
I've lost 60 pounds since I went over to Japan.
How much weight will you have to lose to get back into the type of wrestling that you want to do when you get back to Japan?
I'd like to get down to about 340 pounds, I guess, 330. Go down from there.
You know, you talked about being homesick for Canada. What were some of the things that you missed about home when you were living in Japan?
I think freedom was a big thing. I wasn't allowed to do anything I wanted when I wanted. Sumo wrestlers are always in the public eye, so you have to be very careful of scandals and things like that.
What was the first thing that you had when you got back to Canada that you hadn't had in a long time?
I guess the first thing I had was my mother's roast beef dinner, I guess.
And did it hit the spot?
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Well, welcome back once again. And how long will it be before you leave for Japan?
I may be leaving as early as the 21st.
Okay, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
WhenItWasCool.com is your source for the best in retro pop culture. When It Was Cool features articles and podcasts on retro TV and movies, toys, action figures, pro wrestling, food, video games, and more. Hit the Patreon button to support us and get instant access to hundreds of premium podcasts and features. Family friendly and fun. WhenItWasCool.com.